Hi, it's Jess. Before we begin, I want to warn you that this episode will contain discussions about domestic abuse, child abuse, and suicide. It's not an easy listen, and you might find some of the stories shared upsetting. If you or someone you know is affected by the issues surrounding our conversation, you can access information and support online. If you are concerned about the safety of a child, go to the NSPCC website on www.nspcc.org.uk. Or for children under 18, it's 0800 1111. You can also visit Refuge's website at refuge.org.uk or call the National Abuse Helpline anytime for free at 0808 2000 247. And if you're struggling with your mental health, you can visit www.samaritans.org. All of these links will be linked in the show notes. Hello, my name's Jess Phillips, and this is Yours Sincerely. Usually in this podcast, I give my guest a chance to celebrate three people who mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who is no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. But this week, we're releasing some special episodes to celebrate International Women's Day, and I'll be speaking to some truly inspiring women about the things they are fighting to change. Terry White is an author, journalist, and former editor of Empire magazine. Her memoir, Coming Undone, is a powerful, honest account of her struggle following the trauma of her abusive childhood and how this led her towards a mental health crisis and her precarious journey back from a life in pieces. Growing up, Terry was a victim of physical and sexual abuse, and she wanted to speak about her experience to help further people's understanding and to help prevent it from happening to other women and young girls. So hello, Terry. How are you?
I'm very good.
You've got here on the train.
I have. The train ran. It ran on time.
I'm going to turn this podcast from a meaningful series into people complaining about trains. I'm here for it. I think that's, you could fill the entire airtime of people doing that. So we normally are here to talk about letter writing, but this is a special International Women's Day edition, and I want to speak to different women about the letters that they would like to share with not just individuals, but the women of the world, mm-hmm. the women and girls of the world. So what is the letter you would like to share today?
The letter I want to share is really to all of the young girls who were basically like I was. So all the young girls who have been abused, whether sexually, whether physically. I remember very vividly as a young girl thinking, you know, my life's basically over. I was abused at five. And I later wrote a book, and I wrote in the book, How Do You Live When Your Life's Ended at Five? And that was the prevailing thing I felt throughout my entire childhood. And as I've got older, I've learned how to live with that and how to live a life. But I still remember that feeling of hopelessness, the feeling that there was nobody there to protect me. Mm-hmm. We grew up poor and working class girls are quite often on the bottom of the pile. Mm-hmm. And I really want to say to them that there is hope, that your life can be as brilliant and beautiful and magical as you want it to be. And that one thing that happened will shape you and will always be a massive part of who you are, but it isn't the totality. Yeah. Of who and what you are.
You're not wrong about that. So I know, obviously, you've spoken about the traumatic childhood abuse that you experienced.
Yeah, so there was a lot of violence in my household growing up from my dad and my mum's partners. And so there was a lot of physical abuse, and living in that terror is something that stays with me into this day. I don't think I've ever been as scared in my life as I was in those moments. But then there was sexual abuse as well. From the age of five for about 2 years, and further incident as well. And it pretty much, I always say I've got very few happy memories of my childhood because it was so dominated by all of that stuff. And that feeling of, we had nobody looking after us. We had nobody really to support us. That has always been something that I found really difficult, and not knowing that there were other people out there going through the same thing or who had been through the same thing. And I felt completely isolated and alone in the world. And, you know, as I say, that's always been part of who I am. And I really kind of, I want to reach back and give that girl and other girls basically the hope that I wish I'd had.
Do you think that, there's no way that it's better now. You and I both know it isn't better. The statistics tell us that it's not better. Yeah. There's still as many girls, women living with domestic abuse and children growing up in that environment. If anything, the statistics show us that it's a growing problem. Yeah. Well, at least people are coming forward about it. But I suppose in that, the people coming forward about it and the conversations about it, there is something better in that. There is some hope to be had in that my children, I mean, obviously my children are not a great example because they grew up basically, you know, working under the desk at a women's refuge. So obviously they know about it. But like their peer, I see in my teenage sons amongst their peer groups, the conversation about this is much less taboo. It is much more likely that schools might be talking about it to varying degrees, I have to say, in my experience. But there is something better about it now than in the 80s.
Yeah, and the truth is, like, it was kind of accepted in the 80s.
100% it was accepted.
It honestly wasn't a big deal for there to be multiple mums at the school gates with black eyes and bruises.
I remember in my playground at in the 80s, I remember an actual altercation between a mom and a dad, like, happening in the playground. And actually, also, you remember the kids who absconded from school a lot. Yeah. I remember there was a girl in my class called Sarah, and she was, if she had 20% attendance. And the kids, I was talking to one of my friends about this, the kids who smelt a bit or, like, were really impoverished.
Yeah.
It was just a reason to, we totally accepted it.
Yeah.
If not made it worse, it is the actual truth of the situation for kids when I was a kid in those situations. And I like to think that is better now.
Yeah, and I think it is. And I think there's just more, as we say, it's not as accepted. You've got to hope the police have made some strides in the last couple of decades. I mean, I remember ringing 999 during one incident, and they came and they separated my mum and her partner at the time. And it was basically like, oh, it's a domestic, you know, no big deal. And I think they actually told her not to wind him up. That was kind of what they left us with. But, you know, I remember we used to see a neighbour sliding down her glass door when she'd get hit. And it just wasn't, it didn't really strike me as anything wrong, even though it felt wrong and terrifying and awful. And we went to a women's refuge for 6 weeks, I think it was, in Wales. And the mad thing was, I spoke to my teacher recently from that time, and she was like, oh, yeah, you weren't the only ones who went to a refuge. You know,
Of course.
There were just other kids who just disappear for a couple of months and come back when the situation was a bit safer. And I do think, you know, social media is obviously evil in many ways. But also, I think it gives, there's a democracy in allowing kids to see that they're not alone, to have access to resources that I certainly didn't. You know, I rang Childline because that in the 80s, that was literally the only thing I thought of to kind of reach out and get help was to ring Childline. I remember seeing the telly ads.
Oh, they were everywhere when we
were
kids.
With the phone number, everybody knew the phone number and rang Childline. But now, you know, I think if I was a kid now and going through that, the acceptance isn't there, but then also the ability to reach out and connect with other people, but also try and get some help. I think it's a slightly healthier situation, even though we know statistically it's
not getting any better. Yeah. So did your mum try and step in and help you?
Well, I mean, she was getting seven bells knocked out of her, so you know there was very little she could do. And I do think, you know, she had my brother when she was 16. She had me when she was 18. She had three kids and two divorces before 30. And I just think she was a kid. She was a kid herself,
totally a kid.
A kid, and she, you know, sought validation through men and through relationships. And I don't think we always came first for sure. But you know, I try and have a bit more empathy these days because I think she was in a nightmare situation. She should have protected us more. That's just...
Of course she should have protected you more. But, I mean, I see this all the time where social services do get involved in cases. where still the tone is to critique the mother rather than support her freedom. Yeah. Happy mums make happy kids is my experience of working in this for very many years. And still too much, it's still too, you haven't kept your kids yeah. safe and it's you who's the one who's being attacked. And yeah, I really worry that that hasn't, the idea of a social services being child-centred has flipped so far to the point where it's like just to criticise the woman. Yeah. And basically, I'm afraid to say, to repeat the words of a perpetrator, say, if you speak up, they'll take the kids away. And that's exactly what they
yeah.
do.
Yeah. And you know, The Guardian's doing a lot of great reporting on this at yeah. the moment in those cases. I've always tried to say, you know, I have a very complicated relationship with my mother, but I think fundamentally the men who...
Yeah, they're the ones to blame.
The men who perpetrated that abuse, it's their fault, each and every one of them.
Have any of them faced any justice?
One did. Mm-hmm. I'm just going through a process with the second. Mm-hmm. But, the you know, like, it's utterly mad to me, like, how we would have the police called on very visible mm-hmm. events and nothing would happen. And we know the statistics around rape and sexual yeah. assault. I mean, so I'm not expecting there to be any justice in the second one. I feel like I should be grateful that I'm, you know, one of the 1% who saw saw him convicted, which is kind of nuts, really, when you think about it.
Absolutely.
I'm absolutely in the minority.
We're a needle in a haystack, yeah. I'm afraid.
And I think with child sexual abuse, you know, the NSPCC estimates it 1 in 20 mm. kids are abused. But that's only what we know of. You know, mm. you and I both know that sexual abuse especially flourishes in secrecy and in silence, and that yeah. it's actually, you know, probably quite rare for kids to fully come forward. So I don't think we've got any sense of the true scale
no,
of what goes on.
Not at all.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So did it go on to have a big impact in your life? So we've had people come on the podcast and talk about incidences of abuse. And I'm often intrigued by where even in a sibling group, it has one effect and a different effect on another sibling. And it was put to me that a child with an adult who believes them, basically a witness, yeah. somebody who bears witness to them yeah. is the difference between it having catastrophic effects on the rest of their life yeah. and it being something that they take as armoury and live with for the rest of their life. It is part of them, but they live with it for the rest of their life. So I presume you've had a bit of both of that.
Yeah, and I think the narrative that people are comfortable with is it makes you stronger and you become, do you know, and I
yeah, it's tedious, isn't it?
That drives me mental because it's like...
It literally does the opposite, yeah. is the truth. It makes you more vulnerable to abuse in later life.
Well, exactly. And so, you know, it's now as an adult that I know that the second man abused me because I was vulnerable and had been 100%. Victimised once and he was a predator. When you're a kid, you go, what have I done to bring this on myself twice? What am I giving out to the world? Mm. What signals am I inadvertently doing at the age of 5, 6, 7, 8? That's giving these men these ideas. But I, you know, I was properly haunted by it for decades, well, probably until recently, and I've had my own son, and I've resolved a lot of stuff. But I mean, my 20s, completely work focused, had no personal life whatsoever, no real relationships with family. And in my 30s, it was, you know, a lot of mental health issues and a lot of drinking and prescription pills. And
substance misuse is, I mean, I've never met a woman with substance misuse problems. To be honest, I've never really met a man with substance misuse who didn't have an incident of trauma.
Yeah, and it's, and you know, and it was always about a sedation effect, because I couldn't handle it. I just couldn't handle thinking about it, feeling what I felt. I felt fundamentally broken for a long time, and that I couldn't be fixed, and that it was just life often felt. And when I was had a lot of suicidal ideation and some suicide attempts. And I always felt it was because, what's the point? It's futile, because this thing was done and it's there forever and there's nothing I can do about it. And that's a really dangerous place to be for 30 years of your life. And I'm not there anymore. I'm not to say I can't go back there, because I think you have to be realistic about what it does to you as a woman. And I think especially as a young girl, how that shapes the woman you become, you feeling like, I always felt fractured as a woman. I had a really complicated relationship with my body and with sex and all of that. And that's not easy to overcome. And I think it's there's no kind of, you know, epiphany where and then you wake up
one
and it's,
day, one you're day. Just fine.
But it's, I think it's a lifelong thing.
It's funny, I lots and lots of women have lots and lots of incidences of, I mean, I'm going to say most women have some incidents of some form of trauma regarding their body in childhood or early adulthood, at least, if not later. And I think for me, I had a baby when I was quite young, so, you know, it came quite early. I had a baby when I was 23. And I was pregnant when I was 22, and it did massively change my life. It made me feel like my body was there for something else, and that, you know, I understand that's almost deeply anti-feminist to say that, but I can't help the way I felt about it. And that I could understand, you know, all that in the, again, in the 80s, all that talk about women having babies to get council flats, as if, like, as if having a newborn baby would be worth a bloody council flat. You'd have to give me a bloody, the Palace of Versailles to have another one. Jesus Christ, I'm going to need some serious investment. The idea that £36 a week benefits would make me have another baby, you'd have to give me 36 million. But the, you know, actually I started to realise why young women were choosing to have babies, because it made them matter in the world somehow. And I felt like, for the first time, like I mattered. And that's terrible, and that's anti-feminist, and there's all sorts of, but it is the way I felt.
But
so.
I think that's fascinating, because I, do you know what, I've never put this together before this moment, but I felt a real agency over my body when I was pregnant.
Yeah.
And not because it kind of had a function, but it was, I felt this power in it, that I could grow a human being, that I could do something that formidable. And it wasn't there for the use of men. It wasn't there, even though you could argue that reproduction is entirely for the use of men, but
also
that's an entirely different debate.
I produced two men.
Well, yeah,
so.
and I produced one. But, you know, it was, I felt the most powerful and most in charge of my body that I ever felt
100%.
When I was pregnant.
The sense of agency it gave me.
I was desperate to have a girl. And when I found out I was having a boy, I was like, oh, God, what if he turns out to be evil? And then there's that weird moment when you have this scan and you see the willy and you're like, I've got a willy inside me. I've got a willy inside me. How weird is it?
Yeah,
that
I'm growing a man inside me. It's so weird, isn't it? It's a weird feeling. I definitely felt that. That was a weird feeling
for me. It is.
But yeah, it did make me feel powerful. And that's almost certainly been given to me by patriarchal norms about, you know, the sort of, you know, the Madonna as the idea of the mother being sort of beatified to the point of ridiculousness. Like, and I, there's no way I'm a Madonna. My God, my children, I mean, my children frequently call me my one first name because I don't respond when they call me mom, apparently. I'm too busy on my phone. But... And they call me Miss as well. And when I, I'm like, when they're moaning at me, they're like, Miss, Miss, because they do it like, and I say, don't call me Miss. And they're like, we spend more time with our teachers than we spend with you. So, you know, I'm by no means a Madonna, but I felt incredibly powerful. And I felt like my body was mine for the, like, the first time in my life.
Yeah, which is weird because you're...
Because it's literally not, it's got a parasite.
Because you've given it over to something else. Something, a function that we're told is pretty much our
also,
only function.
You don't care about, and for me, because I was young, I was, you know, living out my heydays. I cared about my health for the first time because it wasn't my health.
Oh my God.
So, like, you know, inflicting poison on it repeatedly, or even just like a lack of mobility on it, was no longer an option. Yeah. It was like, right, this is a machine and it has somebody else's. Heart relying on it. So get a grip, woman.
But it's true. I was the healthiest I'd ever been. Like, obviously, I didn't drink, didn't take drugs. I didn't self-harm anymore, which I'd had a problem with for years. I was like, my body is now, I understand what I need to do and I'm going to look after it. And it was amazing. It gave me a respect for my body and a desire to look after it that I'd never, ever had. I was like, let's destroy it and annihilate it.
It's, I mean, it, you know, as I'm saying this, you know, it made me feel powerful, but it is so in line with the idea that women are meant to be carers and women, you know, like all of that. Yeah. I suppose as a feminist and somebody who talks about all the things that you talk about as well, I think it is important for people to sort of let themselves off the hook. We're all groomed by the society that we're in, aren't we? But it is powerful. It is. And so, I started to understand why a 16-year-old kid who'd never had anything might have a child. So your mum, I can understand why she did it.
Yeah. You know, they've got, it's that sense of control. I never associated pregnancy with a sense of control. Yeah. I was anti having kids for years, was like definitely not going to do
it. That might have been a wise choice. I look at my friends who are childless and think, smart.
Yeah.
You're on holiday in Jamaica again.
I know, but you see, I don't know if I had it worse because I didn't have my son until I was 40 and I'd had this like...
I mean, I'm going to make you feel bad now. I'm 41 and I have an 18-year-old child, so it's very easy for me.
I
see my mates in the street and they're like, oh, you're childless today. I'm like, I'm childless every day. I don't really have children anymore. They're adults.
But you see, I spent 2 decades being entirely selfish, doing exactly what I wanted. I was single for most of it. I lived in New York. I travelled wherever I wanted to travel. I did exactly what I wanted to do at all times. I was so brilliantly selfish. It was amazing. And then obviously I got pregnant and I was like, life's probably going to have to change a tad. Life is now completely unrecognisable. I love my son, but it's like I'm living an entirely different existence because I am living an entirely different existence.
Oh, you are.
I can't be a selfish cow all the time anymore.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting that back. I think I did it the right way around because, you know, now, I mean, I suppose, you know, you did a lot. I did no gallivanting. I basically went on holiday to Cornwall for most of my 20s because I had children and I camped and things. But I'm going to get it back at the other end.
Well, you know,
and
I'm going to be 60.
I've got more money now. I was poor then.
Well, I'm going to be 60. But so somebody said to me, oh, don't worry. Like, it's, you wait till they go to school. Or, no, wait till they leave home, you'll get your life back. And I was like, right, that'll make me... Oh, 60. Brilliant. I can't wait to get my life back.
I feel incredibly smug. and obviously now you want to make it for your children, like, you know, a completely different experience to the one that you suffered as a child, just total safety. Do you think that makes you, like, nervous of them or actually freer?
I am a bit of an overprotective.
Yeah.
So he falls over and like bangs his knee and I literally drop whatever I'm holding and run across the room. A kid pushed him over at a soft play party the other day and I had to stop myself like getting up and going for that kid. So I am quite protective. But it brings me great joy to know that he is, he's never going to be, well, you know, the thing that actually makes me feel sick is the thought of him ever being scared or somebody being mean to him or something bad. Like, I can't handle some kid. I thought some kid gave him the dead eye the other day. And I was obsessed with, like, this kid and whether he was upsetting him and was he mean to him when I wasn't around? And yeah, it's a slightly different cup of tea.
Yeah, yeah.
Different cup of tea, different kettle of fish.
Different kettle of fish.
Kettle of tea.
Get your horses together, my mum used to say. Like, mix your metaphors. Get your horses together. So the long-term effects for many children who experience this in early life are absolutely are great. But you have provided words of comfort today. Like, you know, it does matter to people to see somebody come through the other side, whether it's 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later. The whole survival victim thing I find a bit tedious because actually you're still a survivor.
Yeah.
When you were five, you were a survivor.
Yeah.
Whether it felt like, you know, you'd be on Take a Break magazine with your punch in the air, you were getting up every day. The fact that you survived, literally you're here to sit here and talk today means... And sometimes that survival will have looked considerably less polished than it looks today.
Yes. Yeah, mainly, I have to say. And I call myself both a victim and a survivor. And I know I understand some people's personal aversion to victim, but I have a real problem with kind of soft soaping. You know, making it more palatable for everybody. How will people respond best to this, especially, you know, middle-class people and people who've not experienced it, maybe. And it's all around palatability of language and these narratives about resilience and overcoming and it all
it's
drives
like making
me
making out
potty.
Like cancer is a battle rather than just a cell deformation that basically...
Something really fucking grim.
Luck will be on your side. Yeah. You can't be morally get rid of cancer.
No.
She's a strong one. It's like the cancer will still get her or it won't. It's luck.
Yeah, I hate all of that.
Oh,
so I freely use the word victim because I was victimised, I was.
Yeah.
But I am also still standing on two feet, so I've got no problem with survivor either. But I'm not a fan of kind of, as I say, this ironing out of language, especially to make everyone else feel more comfortable. I want you to feel uncomfortable. Child abuse, like whether it's sexual or physical or, you know, is horrific. The fact that there are... definitely working class girls in this country who feel that they are the kind of as low down the pecking order as it
possible.
Goes.
So if someone listening to this suspects a child is being abused in some form, what would you say to them?
So I am a childhood campaigner for NSPCC. So I would always recommend ringing their helpline because I didn't even realise till I started working with them that it's not just for kids to ring, that actually if you suspect something, have a worry, you're not sure what to do, their advisors are amazingly trained and they'll talk you through what it is. But also if it's something like school, there's always a safeguarding lead. Basically, don't just shut your mouth because I think...
Because do you know what? Sometimes you might just be wrong.
Yeah. And they'll
better to be wrong.
Completely. And I think that British thing of like, oh, it's not my business, it's somebody else's family. You know, every child in society is all of our responsibility.
We are in loco parentis of them all.
Exactly.
Recently, it was on Vinted. I was selling something on Vinted, and as you can see, I have a birthmark on my arm. Yes, so I never think about it because I've had it my whole life. And I was holding something in a photo on Vinted, and a woman got in touch with me who'd bought something off me and said, I just wanted to check, are you all right? I saw the bruises on your arm. And I got back to her, I said, it is just my birthmark, but I have spent today with... police forces, probation services and children's services all explaining to me why nobody did anything and there are three children dead.
Yeah.
Thank you for being the person who didn't think it was too precious to just say, are you all right, love?
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean, and it's
not rocket science.
It isn't. I think people should feel responsible and they should, you know, especially when it comes to kids, if you suspect anything is happening, and like you say, if there's note going on, they'll find out that there's note going on, like they really will. And I think it's people absolve themselves of responsibility, basically, and they don't get to do that.
I didn't think when somebody called me and was like, you know, like when somebody said, is that, I didn't think, oh, you're having a go at my husband. He's a lovely man. It was like, oh, no, thanks for caring. I didn't think anything of it. And if the school safeguarding got in touch with me and said, we've had something about the kids, I would be grateful that they'd cared.
Well, I remember when my boy was in nursery And he went through this phase of banging his head on the floor.
Yeah, my son did that. It's like an actual thing. It's a thing that some of them do. He plays the drums now to get it out.
Mine does. Yeah, yeah,
there you go.
Mine's a mad drummer.
Yeah, he used to just bang his head repeatedly on the floor. Apparently it's a fairly normal thing.
Well, so I'm like in bits about it, but I take him to nursery and I get a phone call saying, we've noticed he's got a bruise on his head. Can you explain how he got it? And I was immediately like, oh, he's banging his head. Oh, and I rang my boyfriend in tears going, they think I've hurt him. And he said, well, look, he went, isn't it better that they do that? Yeah. Because when you were a kid, nobody rang, nobody did anything. And he went, imagine if they had. And it was a real like light bulb moment for me. And I just thought, just the fact they'd done that and cared and were willing to ask the question, because they just asked me really bluntly. And as his mum, I was like, I can't believe they think I'd hurt him, but... Of course, why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they?
You're more likely to hurt him than anyone else, is the truth. Your parents, or people in your family are more likely rather than the whole... We obsess about stranger danger with our children, actually. I remember a man once offering to walk me back to my car from a late-night council meeting. I said, well, that's nice of you, but statistically, you're more likely to rape me than I am to be raped by a stranger on the way. But thanks for the offer.
I was going to say, how did that go down?
it's always cheap. My husband's like, you're always a ray of sunshine, Jess.
He'll be telling that story going, can't do anything right these days.
Yeah. So how would you sign off your letter to the women of the world? What would you say?
I would say that there is, whatever you've been through, whatever has been done to you, there is always hope, and that life will be happy again at some point. It won't be a ray of sunshine all the time. You will have pain, you will have trauma, you will have difficulties, but there is joy and happiness still to be found, I swear to God. And if I can find it in life, you can definitely find it.
Oh, well, Terry, thank you so much. It's really, really uplifting to hear it. And yeah, it's not always pretty, survival, but it's deeply impressive when people want to talk about it and share. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you click the follow button now on the app where you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. This has been an Audio Always original.